So welcome to the podcast. This week, I'm here with Zach Lokes, artist, designer, farmer, teacher, and author known for the Edible Ecosystem Solution, the Permaculture Market Garden, and the Two-Wheel Tractor Handbook, as well as his Ecosystem U courses on edible ecosystem design. Welcome, Zach.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Also here with Trace Crow, co-host.
Our second in a series, kind of loosely around the what to do with the suburbs. How do we handle all of this historical investment in the suburbs to make them usable?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think since you've already been a guest and talked about a few of your other aspects, like I listened to plenty of your guest spots on podcasts before, on the two-wheeled tractors and your market garden experience and stuff. So definitely highly recommend everyone else look up those podcasts. But today we wanted to focus a little bit more around the topic of this series, which is on what we can do with the suburbs, potentially them as a regenerative canvas, and digging on there. I'll kick it off. Are you an optimist? Do you consider yourself an optimist?
Yeah. You know, I think I've actually, for a long time now, I think optimism would be something I would put in my quiver as one of my great tools. I truly believe that the world has better places around the corner. We really haven't hit our full stride in terms of how we have relationships with land and how we have relationships with each other. So I think that if you see the landscape as mostly an empty canvas, then there's lots of good to do with it.
Nice. In your work on the edible ecosystems in general, since that's something you've been pretty active with, you talk a lot about organized food plant systems in neighborhoods. What kind of scale would you hope to see this on? Like, is it a public thing? Do you see it more as a like residential organizations contributing on their own space, or do you see this more as like a public endeavor or a governmental endeavor?
Yeah, I think it can go to all scales, all situations. The beauty of edible ecosystem design is it's a modular approach to land management, meaning that small units of just 25 square feet, 5 feet by 5 feet, take a piece of lawn 5 feet by 5 feet, and turn it into a variety, a complement of edible and useful plants, food plants, little micro garden spots, but that they can link together in a way that allows them to create larger landscapes. So you could strategically link them along a fence line in your yard. You could strategically link so you can strategically link them along a boulevard. It could be in a park, a larger space. So because everything's modular and you can think of it as building edible spots or edible hedges or edible plots, then you can translate that into that corner between, you know, two fence lines for a spot, or that entire fence line for a hedge, or an entire park for a plot. And because of that, it really begs to have stakeholders at different scales, stewards that have different relationships with the land, that can be neighbors in a neighborhood that are all putting in spots with trees that cross-pollinate each other. You know, that can be a community garden group that decides to transition an entire community garden to an edible perennial garden system that's much more self-regulating and much more resilient in the long term than annual vegetables that require a lot of annual investment. But that can, you know, relate to a real estate company that decides that they are going to develop new suburban developments from scratch. And well, they're going to integrate edible plantings. And, you know, that could be, let's put in a good soil in the back for a backyard garden. Or it could be, let's make sure to have frost-free plumbing that is running underground with hydrants sticking up right at the corner of the garden, strategically placed for simple irrigation solutions and washing of vegetables right out of the garden. You know, these are really simple design ideas. So, you know, part of edible ecosystem design is both the concept that it's about a wild ecosystem type model, but it's also an ecosystem. So you have to think about irrigation and tool systems. And, you know, if you want to use tool tractors, for instance, which you mentioned in my most recent book, which is the right scale of equipment for installations in urban and suburban areas by landscape companies, by cities that could take on equipment and do these installations themselves. So you can have an entire city council that gets behind it and say, okay, well, you know, we're going to transition, you know, all the underutilized green space in our community to an edible bike lane, or we're going to create a whole series of educational walks throughout our town with edible plantings. So it's a good question. And I guess the answer is that yes, it can go to any scale. You know, you can do anything with it. You know, you could plant the entire length of a highway if you wanted. Mm. You know, you think about the strips between major highways across middle America. Some of them have really large spaces between them, mm-hmm. just like 100 feet wide. Mm-hmm. Well, that could be a row of pecans, you know, going that whole length, and then it could switch up to other varieties and diversity as your hardiness zones change. And then wouldn't that be interesting to see those ecotones as you go along that highway as it changes? So all scales possible, but what's important is to start really small. So a single tree with a handful of companions in a 5 foot by 5 foot space, and then grow modularly from there.
Nice. That's kind of cool.
What are some of the top trends that you're seeing? Like you said, you're an optimist about this. What are some of those trends you're seeing that make you optimistic? Or that you imagine will kind of morph into these kind of ideas more at scale?
Yeah. Well, you know, I've seen hotels that have put fruit trees out front and have bees on the roofs. And I've seen some doing a good job, and I've seen some doing an okay job, right? So what I see is that there's the interest there, and now it needs to be applied in a way where there's a lot of, you know, so now we want to see a sort of intelligence in the interest in having food plants in communities where there's a much higher level. It's not just like, oh, we should plant some fruit trees. Okay, let's just grab some from a nursery and have our yard keeper at the hotel drop them in. But more like, hey, we should have an edible landscape design made for our entire green space. And even more so, we're a massive hotel chain. We should have this done for all new hotels and consider all existing hotels, right? Like, so we got to build on that bit of enthusiasm that you're starting to see, and mm-hmm. then really take it to the next level. But, you know, certainly there are trends happening. People are interested in having food in their yards. You're seeing more gardens. You know, I see a lot of stuff as I move through cities and stuff. And so, you know, I'll notice that some places, you know, have gardens because generationally you can tell that they're from that generation, or they're from that part of the world. You know, they're Eastern European, and they're holding on to the values of the kitchen garden, even though they're in a Canadian or American city. And you can see that they're holding that old world ethic that of course you grow food in your yard, you know? And so, and then you see this, the new buildings that, you know, where people are kind of, you know, doing it because they got inspired, they heard it was cool, or now they want to kind of get involved with like food. But they're coming from like this new ethic of being new age and having food and being healthy and things like that. And so you can see the differences in those type of gardens. You know, the one of them is like, it's like I plowed my entire yard and it's like a big soil canvas. And every year I plant my massive kitchen garden and I put in my 6 favorite crops, versus I have these like $1,000 planters that were built and I have some tomatoes in them. Yeah. And I don't mean to poke fun. I think that's a fine investment of $1,000, you know, I really do. It's okay. Like, way to spend money on a beautiful food growing system, you know, and great to know that you can do it on less too, right?
Yeah.
But this is what you see, is these sort of things. So overall, what does it mean? People who have traditions of growing food are still holding on to those traditions. And people who don't have traditions of growing food are finding them.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's a super cool outlook, going back to what you started on with the hotels. Cause like the more we look around, like with that mindset, like there's so much room for this absolutely everywhere. Like you said, even the highway strips, there's actually one large freeway up north of Montreal, and they hay it in the middle, which is pretty funny to see. I've seen them out there with the tractor and everything. But at least they're doing something. So one of the common critiques of a lot of these things is, like, when you start talking about introducing foodscaping and like ecological edible landscaping into cities, is people complain about the mess and stuff like that. I know, like, we know that's not an issue, but like, do you ever have to like mitigate those types of things when talking to people about this?
Oh yeah, all the time. Yeah. I think one of my YouTube videos, I sort of did something where I was like, all right, I was like walking through the street somewhere. I was like, all right, let's get this out of the way. Here are all the things that people are going to say for why we shouldn't grow food in cities. You know, here they are. Let's knock them off. Right. And one of them is the mess. So people say, oh, the fruit will fall on the ground. It'll be a mess. It'll be sticky. It'll attract wasps. There'll be mess. There'll be this. There'll be that. And the number one thing I have to say about that is, if you pick fruit, it's not on the ground. So if you don't utilize something, it's not on the ground. It is a funny sort of ignorance to pretend that, for instance, in the city of Winnipeg, all the elm trees are not creating a mess every year.
One of the main things that people talk about with growing food in city, fruit in particular, perennial fruits and stuff in cities, is that there's going to be a mess. And right off the bat, I like to think, well, there's already a mess. Like, the elm trees in Winnipeg are already producing a mess, in quotes, right? You can't have the benefits of ecological systems without the so-called mess. But this is a mess we would rather live with.
Yeah.
That's why, for instance, you know, thousands and thousands and thousands of elm trees were planted across the city of Winnipeg, and millions of them have been planted across cities all over North America. And trees are a big part of city planning and have been for the past 100 plus years, because we want to have the benefits of shade, right? And you couldn't imagine living in a city without its shade trees. Well, if you lived in an old growth fruit forest city right now, you wouldn't be able to imagine living without it. You would think I was bat, you know, manure crazy, you know? So it's like, which is guano. So you'd think I was crazy to say that. So these things come with their so-called mess, but they're only a mess if you don't apply the technology to it. So then the second part of this statement is, in what world, where we've been to the moon, where we're planning to go to Mars, are we not able to apply simple technique and technology and species selection to maximize harvest of city fruits and minimize waste and mess? In what world are there not people already employed in cities doing all sorts of jobs?
Yeah.
You know, if we create a holistic plan for our cities, what we're going to do is end up with more green jobs and more yield from the city, more overall ecosystem services, right? Ecosystem services, in the case of a tree, being fresh oxygen, reduction of pollution, reduction of stormwater surges, reduction of the urban heat island, and, oh yes, production of fruit, berries, nuts, herbs, and everything else good under the sun that you can eat. So there is no mess unless you forget to pick it and enjoy it. And if we do, we've got a misstep in terms of how we're managing our land. And the third part to this, there is a third part. The third part is, if we plant things and they're messy, and then they're in our face, and then they tell us, hey, why aren't we making use of this? You know, why aren't we, you know, people will also say, oh, well, what about eating fruits from city streets or things where, oh, the smog, isn't it polluted? Like, do you not want to eat it? And I'm like, what a great predicament to be in, to be concerned about how much smog is on your neighborhood street because of your fruit. That is allowing the fruit to lead the conversation instead of allowing the exhaust to lead the conversation. Right. That's what we want. Plant it, and then we will continue to build the solutions for what we want.
Nice. Well put. I can already think of a few examples. Like, again, like, if you build it, they will come. Like Vancouver, completely overgrown with Himalayan blackberries, right? It's a super invasive, growing on cedars like 50 feet tall, but you better believe every summer they're picking. There's people out there with buckets and buckets of them. All right. So Zach, you've done a bit of traveling, I believe, in your life. I heard on some of your other podcasts. Are there any places in the world that you think are doing like foodscaping well, or that are patterns we should be looking to when it comes to management and design?
You know, what I find is that, well, in Europe, they have a lot of gardening going on in communities. Like, you know, the model in Europe is less of a suburban sprawl and more of like you have a town and then, you know, there's another town and they're all really close together. Like if you're driving along in the hills in France or Italy or someplace, like you just see towns all over, right? You can see them. They're here. And everybody has their homes around the town and they all have big gardens and orchards in them for the most part, right? So, and again, that gets back to what we were talking about a bit with that old world ethic. So if you go to places in the world where there's an old world ethic, where your cultural connectivity of culture and food are one, you'll see there's gardening going on. Mm-hmm. So wherever it is in the world, you know, I find that you'll see that there's that. North America's a bit of an anomaly because there's been a severing of that. And so what happens here is people who are following their cultural norms from where they come from, if they remember them, you still see the gardening, and then everyone else has forgotten it. And it's coming back around a little bit as a new wave, right? But so, yeah, you know, it just depends on where you are. But in China, they grow food all over the place. Mm-hmm. You know, in Europe, in Italy, they're growing food all over the place. Like they're, you know. But the funny thing is, then when I talk to Italians, the Italians really like my books. They're really into permaculture, and they don't think there's enough going on at all there. They think we're so backwards. So you know, what's interesting is everywhere you're where you're at, and of course there's more that you can do. Of course there's more you can do. So it's you know, here in North America, I just want to see more people, period, have a garden, right? Where in Europe, it's like, okay, how do we do the next level with the agriculture, and how do we do next level with like the boulevards, you know, and things like that, and make more use of it. Like they have, you know, ornamental oranges all over parts of Spain, but how much are they using? Can they grow more varieties that are going to be used? You know, that's the next level. It's not enough just to have the ornamentals, right? Like, so, you know, that's what I would say is that, you know,
okay,
you see a little bit this, that.
Nice. Yeah.
I kind of wanted to highlight something you said. We were talking about the mess, you know, and you had amazing responses to it. But the other thing is if you plant with like habitat, right, for different species, you don't end up with a lot of waste anyway, right? I mean, animals will take care of it. I mean, you know, I think that what people have in mind is they think of like crabapple trees or like mulberries, right? But they're like, it's a mulberry and it's like the only vegetation for like three city blocks, right? So if you plant that mulberry with several other shrubs and bushes that provide nesting ground and habitat for birds, they'll take care of that. You know, you'll actually be fighting them. You'll be worried you're not getting enough for people, right?
Yeah. Farmers laugh at that, right? Because we're like, well, we're we're trying to get the food before everything else gets it. And it's true, you know. And it's a mess if it's the one tree and it's falling on pavement. But if we transition more land into growing space, then those fruits fall into soil and understory. And if they're not eaten and not picked, then they germinate into plants, and then you move them and propagate new spaces, you know, and that's how you find mother trees, you know, is about allowing those seedlings to germinate. So it's a big part of it is prioritizing more land to growing and allowing it to grow in that understory. And so it's not just, you know, trees in these little circles with pavement all around them. Like, that's one of the tricks in more dense urban areas is connect those street trees, connect them, remove the pavement between and make it an edible hedge, make it a hedge, make it a connected space, you know, buffer, you know, the street, keep the street and the sidewalk buffered with this hedge.
Yeah, one thing I see here in Atlanta that they love to do, developers love to do, is they love to put a few trees in islands, like in the middle of parking lots, right? But it's you know, if you, the only water that's getting to that tree's roots are landing right, like right straight down, because, you know, its roots are extending underneath the cement, right? And so they end up, I mean, none of these trees ever survive. They always end up being very sickly and struggle, and they die decades earlier than they would normally. And it seems to me, I bring that up because it seems to me that there is functionally a misunderstanding or a lack of understanding about just basic ecology, right? And the way, like in biology, like how plants and animals like live, right? And survive. Because that's not a hard design. That's not a hard thing to design around, right? Like you know, in some cases, just don't put a tree there, put shrubs and bushes and things that are going to be maybe more shallow rooted. But in others, it's just simply like change slightly to the design of the bed around the tree. Right. And maybe you're sacrificing a parking spot, but probably you're not. Like, probably in the end, you could design it like, you know, where you're not sacrificing a parking spot. But I don't think that, I think that the people that are usually making decisions have absolutely no idea about ecology, you know, and about the way plants and animals and the environment interact with one another.
And, it's like a checkbox.
Yeah, I mean, they really are just a checkbox. And, you know, and then they'll pitch it as like, oh, this is a green parking lot, right? We have five or six trees, you know, for 200 cars. You know, or 200 parking spots,
impermeable surfaces, six trees, ornamental invasive species.
Check.
And the places that end up being like the most functional ecosystems in a way are like the wooded area on the fence line that they just leave alone, right?
I love that. Like those rough areas. I was cruising through Detroit recently, and like the rough, forgotten spaces were looking pretty nice. You know, like wildflowers, rogue mulberries, you know. Raspberries.
There's a beautiful little island in Montreal. It's like between the train tracks and behind some giant office building. It was in a part of town that was like pretty forgotten, obviously, for a long time, but it's essentially a field, and there's now mature walnut trees in there. It's been forgotten for so long, but it's becoming like a popular area again. But they often cut the fences on the train tracks because it's a shortcut across. So now you walk through these beautiful fields, and there's apple trees like in full bearing. Like, there's wildflowers everywhere. There's mature walnut trees. It's super nice, and you're walking between neighborhoods, and it's this nice little secret kind of corner. A super nice little paradise, you know. There's people have brought picnic tables in there from the neighborhood and stuff, so it's super cool to see.
One thing I wanted to ask you is about education, because that's a lot of what you do, and it seems like the education gap is that's, to me, that seems like one of the largest things holding us back, is that just not enough people know how easy it is to get started, right? Or the small things that you can do all over the place. And especially people in positions of power, like positions to actually, you know, make decisions about how we use our public spaces, or these interstitial spaces, which make up a surprising amount of urban and suburban areas, right? Mm-hmm. What has your experience been with that on the education circuit? You know, are you finding that it's just like heads exploding everywhere you go, or are people really open to these concepts?
Teaching at ag conference, I teach at ag conferences, I teach at like homesteading conferences, things like that. And so people are coming to get educated about homesteading and farming. But I mean, I also work with, like right now I'm working with a high school and doing a series of workshops in their classes with different classes that have different streams, and then collaboratively creating input for an edible ecosystem living laboratory in their back field. So, you know, and there's interest, right? But it's figuring out how to work within the system to get this added into high school curriculums and college university programs. And, you know, I've given talks to groups of teachers and professionals within just the education stream overall in North America, and just kind of thinking about, well, a lot of interest for educators is how they can start to walk the talk in the green spaces on campus. So just showing, you know, different levels of solutions for that on campus, like here's the, you know, easy kind of thing you can do, and here's the more, you know, elaborate sort of thing you can do with your green space. You know, you could just develop a wildflower meadow and let it grow, you know, and that's nice. You're sequestering carbon, you're building habitat for pollinator species, etc. You know, you can have a little kitchen garden that is run by the student group or by some core staff. You know, you can develop edible walkways along all of the, you know, walkways in the, you know, center of the campus, et cetera. Like there's a lot of different layers of what you can introduce. So it's showing people the possibilities, and then how that can link with curriculum. So you're getting this outdoor education experience, this living laboratory experience, that's going on. So, you know, it's a big scope when we, you know, when you say education, there's a lot that gets covered in that. But on the simplest level, you know, you're right when you said that, you know, people don't always realize how simple it is to get started. So I do think it's important, you know, whether you're talking about, you know, education in terms of teaching individuals how to grow food, or education in terms of changing the educational infrastructure at schools and universities, that you show the simplest solution first and then you build up from there. So, hey, plant a tree, you know, plant a tree, dedicate it to the, you know, the student union or something of that year, and plant a mulberry tree or something like that. And, you know, get going. And so I always recommend, like, start with the stuff that's easy too, right? If you're a designer or whatever, like I live in the Northeast, I never tell anyone to grow an apple, you know, like, nah, there's apples everywhere. And there's a million diseases that attack apples because they've been around since I don't know when, Adam and Eve, right? So it's like, no, so let's take something a little more interesting and like not as disease prone for people who are just getting into it. You know, get them excited, have success, you know, try an autumn olive, try a mulberry, you know, try a choke cherry. Like I get buckets of choke cherries and they're so easy, and it's just like choke cherries, you know, everywhere. And it, raspberries, grow some raspberries, you know, easy, you know, you already know them and you love them, and they're, you know, so learn what is, like, you know, every designer or every educator or every, you know, individual that's trying to inspire change in their area should create a short list of plants that they know in their area are pretty darn easy to grow. And then they should just walk around the streets all day long being like, you should plant this. You should plant this. Next year, plant this. You won't regret it, you know? Mm-hmm. So.
Nice. I've been following along with your Walk Across Ware project and the Walk Across Winnipeg project. I think that's super cool as like a sort of ecology and botany nerd myself. I'm always like, ooh, what's that? Identifying all these things. My family hates walking with me because I'm just like inspecting every little thing. But what are your most interesting findings on this? Like, are you finding that there's like, is there a capacity for wild, like, is there more wild food out there than we're expecting or than?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, just to update everyone. So the Walk Across Ware campaign is essentially, I do these impromptu walks across cities or neighborhoods, and I'm just looking at what's going on. So I'm taking a bit of a census in terms of what is currently being grown in yards and, you know, in the city overall, and what potential is there. So I'm trying to look at the underutilized landscape. And so what am I seeing? I mean, you see a lot of underutilized landscape, obviously, right? Like, and I like to just point it out again and again and again. I feel like this broken record, but I feel like if you point it out and you see that opportunity, you know, you point it out again, you see that same sort of opportunity. It sort of resonates that there's a lot of opportunity, you know, optimism, right? There's opportunity everywhere. You know, I found this like huge green space next to a fire hall. And I was like, we need like the, you know, firefighters food forest here, you know? Mm-hmm. I was like, this would be amazing. You know, only red fruits allowed, you know? But like, so there's a lot of opportunities. So that I'm seeing everywhere. And in some places I'm seeing really cool opportunities, you know, like I'll find areas where I can tell that money is being invested in the green space, mm-hmm. but they're not doing anything interesting with it. Mm-hmm. So I like to see that, you know, I'm like, ha, I'm like, look, there's trees being planted and they got like good support systems and there's all sorts of stuff going in. They're planting lots and there's still tons of room. So I'm like, this is an area where there's active planting money. Mm-hmm. So that just to me is like opportunity, right? So, you know, I like to look at that, you know, I'll find like a lot of these areas where you'll get into these bike lanes or old train tracks. And it's just these long linear spaces that cross across huge neighborhoods with lots of different, you know, connections between different peoples from different walks of life and all underutilized. And the bike lanes are just like, they're the simplest thing to plant, you know, just put a guy on a two-wheel tractor for a day and just make a raised bed down the whole side of it, you know, and then come back the next day with 100 people and 10,000 trees and you're done, you know, like, throw some rodent guards in there, a couple support stakes and, you know, hook up some water, right? I guess. You know, but it's straightforward compared to planting a large park or compared to planting multiple yard units. Like bike lanes are the low hanging fruit, pun intended, of transitioning urban communities, suburban communities to edible biodiversity benefits. They really are. So
yeah,
I'm always looking at bike lanes and taking pictures and videos of that sort of thing. So, but then I also see a lot of cool stuff. So people, you know, be encouraged. Like there's people doing ecological badassery all over the place, you know, like there are earth warriors all over the place transitioning their yards and planting. I mean, just and they look like everybody. That's what I love, you know, like one of them's 23 and he's like, what up, you know, look at my ill, you know, raspberry hedge and my espaliered pear and my like, you know, hardy kiwi, you know, trellis with my water system, right? And the other person's like 53 and she's like a school teacher. And she's like, yeah, I just started planting this garden on the other side of this bike lane across from my house. It's not really my land, but I mentioned it to the people and they were like, yeah, sure, you could do that. And so I just keep doing it. And I'm like, you're like guerrilla gardening. Like, that's awesome. You're a school teacher, you know? So, you know, and then there's Baba, right? Like Baba with her garden that puts us all to shame, you know, because she's going like a quarter acre all by herself out there, you mm-hmm. know. Like, so you see all these things, you know, when you're in the back alleys and you're in the side streets and things like that. And so I think it's a good thing to experience. You know, I recommend everyone walk across their cities as the, you know, wolf would walk sort of thing, just sort of finding your way because you discover things. And then I think it's really important to show that and share that, show and share all the opportunity that exists again and again and again, these green spaces that are underutilized, and show and share these people that are doing really awesome projects, you know, so that you can see them and look at specific areas with specific site designs. So, you know, that's the thing to kind of get into. So I'll be doing that kind of in the coming years. I'm going to be taking my drone out and making designs in situ in some of the places I've discovered, you know, places I put dots on the map. I said, this is a badass spot. I'm gonna come back here and fly my drone and take some aerials and create a design while I'm sitting there, you know, and then just post them or something. So.
Nice. Mm. That's super cool. I love the idea of the underutilized space. That's something that Trace and I keep coming back to, especially when it comes to the suburbs and urban spaces. I think, like, without forcing people to garden, which is also something that comes up when you suggest that, hey, maybe we should grow more food in the cities and stuff, you know, people are like, oh, not everyone wants to be a subsistence gardener. But like, the reality is we have so much marginal space that is literally wasted on lawns or collecting dirt and trash, you know, like,
yeah. And then don't be a subsistence gardener. I think that very few people, honestly, I've sort of changed my mind on this over the years. I think very few people should honestly be a subsistence gardener. Mm-hmm. I think most people should have a couple fruit trees in their yard.
Yeah.
You know, and that's a lot of fruit trees if everybody does that, mm-hmm. you know. And then some people want to be really badass and, you know, convert their front yard to an edible medicinal meadow or something like that. But most people should have, if even the people who really are dedicated, who are still busy, you know, they should be producing an edible wilderness in their yard, not a hardcore garden intensive fruit production. They should be walking around their yard enjoying and eating, and then we should have systematic permaculture market gardens in our large green spaces in cities, period. Run by organizations, run by individual businesses, run by the city, who cares? But that is what I would imagine would be the secret to a really good transition, is people have really low maintenance, edible, wild landscapes in their yards. And then we have really highly maintained permaculture, market garden, food forests in our larger spaces and linear spaces and things like that. Mm-hmm.
Nice. Yeah, I love that idea. That's I think it's a pretty nice sort of prescription for where we could be for being sovereign with our own food.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, there's you know, I think the last tally was there's 50 million acres of lawn in the United States. And if we were to plant all of those acres with fruit trees, we would increase our fruit production by 5 times. We have, like, you know, 5 times more lawn than we do orchard space in the entire United States. And it's astounding the amount of wasted space. Like, when you, especially I what I really appreciate is when you go walk through places on foot, you do notice a lot of what's going on, and you realize how like hypertrophic everything is. It's just giant, right? Especially in the US. And they're just huge swaths of space that's just not used.
Oh, yeah.
And it's not being used for anything. And we're spending, the worst is we're spending money on maintaining it. You know, we're paying someone with a gas mower to go out there, you know, once a month and mow a field of grass, basically.
Well, that's it. That's back to the point is that people are being paid in cities to maintain the land. You just have to switch what they do with their time, right? You know? So.
Yeah.
Right. And I guess eventually the idea is that fruit trees are much lower maintenance anyways. If you have fruit trees underplanted with some flowers and whatnot, that's less lawn, that's less fertilizers to throw around.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And just switch the aesthetic a little bit. Like, you know, I like a little bit of mode space as much as the next guy if I'm going to kick a soccer ball or play some frisbee or something like that. But we don't need to have mowed grass everywhere. You can have some spaces that are allowed to just be wild, just allow them to be wild, you know? And if you establish them with chosen varieties, then the wild spaces are highly productive to your needs, you know? So, hey, that's just wild over there. But you walk closer and you're like, yeah, it's wild. It's full of thyme and lemon balm and chives and bee balm and anise hyssop and raspberries and currants and hascaps and grapes and pears and mulberries and saskatoons and currants and gooseberries. And you're right, it's wild, you know? All you need to do is mow the edge of it so that people can walk along and pick it. And if it's wild and it's, you know, 100 feet dense of wild edible goodness, then good. Every 10 or 15 feet, mow a path through it. You know, there's your mowing job. Just trade up for a flail mower, you know?
Thanks.
I spent some time just this fall in a wild area. And as far as I could see, it was saskatoons, blueberries, choke cherries, and wild rose.
Nice.
That's an edible ecosystem. People say, well, what's an edible ecosystem? That's what an edible ecosystem is. Some are more obviously useful for humans. And some less so. That one for a slightly, you know, edible educated person is obviously useful, right? There's multiple edible species there, you know, but a little bit of design, you just recreate that at home. Great. Okay. I'm going to create a patterned plot with choke cherries and raspberries and, you know, blueberries and strawberries and saskatoons, you know. And then let it be wild, right?
Nice. I like that idea too. Is that how you would see like the market garden sort of pattern for suburbs? Do you see it more like the food forest, or is it more intensive with a mix of annuals and perennials? And
well, so I mean, I design and develop different types of edible ecosystems. So on one level, you were producing a native ecosystem restoration. It's all native plants. It's a restoration of native plants. It could be a tall grass prairie, for instance. Now, we might lean on more edible, medicinal, useful plants, more, you know, apparently useful plants, such as, you know, sweetgrass, you know, like things that people know about using and can readily use. I mean, it's easy to use sweetgrass. You cut it, you braid it, you know. So and then I would do what I call a cultivar edible ecosystem. So again, it's, you know, of course wild, but the varieties are named varieties. You know, it's not wild choke cherries, it's domesticated cherries, right? It's varieties that we've named and we've cultivated over, you know, hundreds and thousands of years. And so then, but we're still creating it to be an ecosystem, right? And then you have to, of course, choose, you know, the type of ecosystem you're trying to emulate. Are you emulating a prairie ecosystem? You know, mostly low growing, medium growing, and tall growing plants that don't have woody stems, for lack of a better description, you know what I mean? So, or are we doing a woodland ecosystem that has a specific ratio of, you know, shrubs and taller trees to open lands, herb lands, grasslands, et cetera? Is it a woodland ecosystem we're creating a mimicry for, you know, or a denser forest ecosystem, you know? So whether it's a native ecosystem restoration or a cultivar ecosystem that we're creating, we're choosing the type of ecosystem that we're either restoring or emulating. And then the last one is a really organized, and you know, you could call it the permaculture market garden, but it would be like what I wrote about in my first book, which is a really organized integration of annuals and perennials. And in this case, the annuals are grown in guilds, but you're running it more commercially.
So yes, things are going wild and they are, you know, propagating themselves and things like that, but you're going in there and you're creating micro disturbances and managing and manipulating the process in order to achieve very, very specific goals for production, right? And so you could do this with native ecosystem plants, or you could do it with cultivar plants. You could do it with both, right? So regardless, I systematically am always creating highly organized beginnings to the planting. The designs are organized. You know, they're in permabeds, or they're in, you know, rows that are planted and patterned specifically based on, you know, the characteristics of the soil and the moisture regime and the microtopography, et cetera. So, but it's very, very organized. And then we let it go wild. So the difference between the first two and the last one is that there's a lot more annual management to hone in and control the wildness so that you have really specific management goals be met on an annual basis. Whereas in the first two, you can let it go wild and you're in there using it and things like that, but it's not as systematic as you might have in a you know, food forest market garden type scenario.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. Would you see that last one as successing onto something else eventually, more wild, or is that just always going to be maintained?
No, it can. Yeah. I mean, it can. I mean, you know, I mean, the last one is what I do, right? Mm-hmm. And then I allow areas in projects that I run on my own property and other properties to be more of the first two where I want them to be, you know? Mm-hmm. So, but I'm increasingly aiming towards the middle one and the first two, but really the middle one, where it's really allowed to go wild, but the intention and the design is so specific. Like imagine a woodland edible hedges that are kind of producing, and they have, you know, fruits and currants and nut trees, pecans and elderberries and, you know, et cetera, all growing, you know. And then in between those hedges, you have meadowlands that are growing, but they're really specifically designed. But it's not just like, oh yeah, check it out. You know, there's, you know, wild edible plants and cultivated plants that are self-seeding, et cetera, in between. But actually there's themes of them that lend themselves to efficiency. Like, what about a meadow where it's all perennial and biannual roots that require, you know, a certain type of harvest? So you can go in there with a commercial type setup and harvest them, but they're a self-perpetuating meadow, but they're roots, right? Or this one has all different types of leafy greens, and there's maybe some other things in there, but for the most part, you could go in there with a commercial greens harvester. Like, I don't know if you've seen some of these, like, you know, battery operated, you know, greens harvesters with a drill or something like that. You can go in there and harvest your greens. But it's a self-perpetuating perennial system. But they're all greens that lend themselves to salads, say. Or in another one, it's teas. So we're creating wild systems, but wild systems that are themed in ways that allow efficient harvest. And that's a big part of where my work in all of this started, was trying to create the sort of efficiencies in permaculture that are necessary in commercial food landscapes.
Nice. I really like that idea too. I feel like that lends to a transition from sort of the current industrialized food system to something that's much more sustainable, realistic, and localized.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. So cool. It seems like, you know, you kind of bring it around full circle to the idea of, like, what do we do with the suburbs in particular? You know, it seems like your first prescription is just start planting things, right? Like, I mean, essentially we have, you know, I think in the suburbs we have there's a lot of raw good there, in that there's a lot of land, right?
Oh, yeah. And
essentially the houses are already set up like little like villas, right, with land around them. And so you can start to just create, you know, three or four neighbors in a line are doing some fruit trees, and they're doing different fruit trees, whether it's coordinated or not. but they're doing different fruit trees. That's a small step that can be a huge gain for the community
down the road. Start planting things, but also one of the things that suburbs have is people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And land needs people. So it's one of the issues with the rural area is there's lots of land, no people. Mm-hmm. Urban area, no land, too many people. Suburbs, as much as they got a bad rap, you know, in the 90s, actually have a great ratio of land and people. So there's the potential to produce highly diversified, intensive operations because there are the people to do the work.
Yeah.
And that makes a world of difference when we have diversity in mind, you know?
Right.
But yeah, what's the, you know, as you say, the prescription for the, you know, the suburbs, you know, it's more like a subscription. It's time to, you know, get on board and, you know, pay your dues with a bit of sweat, you know, but what's the plan? Plant a tree in your yard, put a metal tag on it. Plant a tree with knowledge behind it. Ask for recommendations. Find a site suitable tree. Find the greatest tree, plant it, love it, laser metal etched tag on it. Let it grow, love it. Throw some companions in around it. You know, put some chives, mix in a current near it, you know, have some buffer around it. Nurture it. Connect it along your entire property frontage as an edible hedge. Repeating patterns of a few great perennials. Encourage your neighbors, offer them to try, to smell, to enjoy, share some jam, give them a cutting, get them to do the same thing. Create that transition and just do a great job with what you're doing. You know, go to your local farmers market, support your local growers so that you're making sure that the land around you stays in farm and transitions towards diversified orchards and diversified market gardens and diversified small grains. Continue to nurture your trees. Continue to play with different spots. Try something in your backyard now. You know, a little bit every year. Don't overwhelm yourself. Ask for more recommendations. Go help your neighbor put a tree in. You know, enjoy and relish the transition of your neighborhood as you see, like, it's your land too. You know, a cherry tree successfully growing in your neighbor's yard is a cherry tree you get to drive by in full blossom every day. You know, enjoy that and watch that transition little by little. You know, look for opportunities to get involved with larger space transition by finding a designer and bringing them in, finding the funds and making it available for the project. Reaching out to a counselor, getting something happening, helping make that link. And then sit back and say, damn, I helped get that big piece of land in the park, that hedge along the ball diamond, that bike lane going. Wow. You know, 15 years in, you do that, you're my fucking hero. You know? That's how you make it. That's how you change it, you know, little by little.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it seems that I think that, you know, COVID, it changed virtually everything, but certainly on the front of reconnecting to the earth, I think it forced a lot of people to slow down and like actually pay attention to where they lived and what was going on. I think I heard a statistic that was like, millennials had like a 67% year-over-year growth in gardening, interest in gardening, between 2019 and 2020. You know, we got to keep that momentum going. I mean, you can kind of tell online, right? Like when you go to Instagram, how many garden influencers there are now, like that's like a legitimate like space now. That's not like fringe. It's like a lot of people with a lot of followers are making decent money talking about gardening and ways to do it better. And I think that, you know, harnessing that momentum, you know, I mean, one thing I can say is that, I've been in the process over the last couple of years of transitioning my whole, I have about 0.8 acres and I'm transitioning it all to like pollinator habitat and fruit trees and shrubs. And, you know,
you're just, my fucking hero.
I mean, just doing it out loud. Like I'm doing it out loud. I'm doing it right in the front yard, making all my mistakes for all my.
That's important, actually. I always say plant your front yard first.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like and get it out there.
Yeah. And it's been amazing.
And then you can stoop it. Who doesn't want to sit in their stoop and watch people walk by and wonder what the hell's going on? And then see the transition over 6 years from what the hell's going on there to holy cow.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's what's going on.
Yeah. And it's shown me how many people are like closet interested in it. Right. Mm-hmm. I've had three different neighbors give me plants because they now know like, this is somewhere that a plant's going to get planted, right? Because it's like a Willy Wonka's chocolate factory. I'll plant anything once, you know? It's a cool little like back and forth that gets started when people realize like there's someone kind of, all it really took was just one person to kind of have the guts to do it out front. And now people in general are starting to be much more open-minded about it. There's a couple other younger neighbors about my age, a little bit younger, who have also started to do, pretty large scale pollinator plantings in their front yard.
Nice.
It makes walking through the neighborhood 1,000 times nicer.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Just nice. Like walking in a street with no, you know, with no sidewalk. And it's just like, it's you on the cement and like,
oh yeah,
100 yards of lawn in every direction, you know, like now you have more stuff to do and see.
That's cool. Yeah. Places that are doing that transition really are beautiful. You know, there's some areas in Portland and stuff where there's really no median. There's just so many flowers and herbs and stuff growing. And, you know, it's really quite nice to be in places like that. You know, in the north, everything's so slow. So we like painstakingly wait, you know, but there's places where all you have to do is have like a couple of years of the idea and all of a sudden it looks amazing. You know?
Yeah, we are pretty fortunate down here in Atlanta, you know, having such a long growing season.
You guys spit out a pit and it grows.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Although we have that clay soil, but if you break it up, it's got plenty of nutrients. Like it's not bad soil. It just needs to be broken up.
Yeah.
And amended a little bit, but.
Great. I think that's probably a good place to leave it for today. Thanks so much for joining us today, Zach and Trace.
Yeah. Good luck on your tour, man. Where are you going?
Now I'm going to be going down the West Coast. So I'll be doing a drive from Winnipeg across over to Vancouver and then cruising down the whole coast. So I'll be hitting some stuff. I'm also going to be doing a bunch of research, just looking at a lot of the, you know, the vegetable belt there and kind of getting a census of what's going on, you know, these days between fires and floods, you know?
Yeah. Are you going to be hitting Northern California at all?
Yeah. Yeah.
Should stop by Posterity Cider Works.
All right.
Someone in the Doomer Optimism circle makes badass cider in Northern California. I don't know where exactly. Do you happen to know, Simon, where he is?
I'm not sure.
Yeah, but it's called Posterity Cider Works.
Yeah, I'll pop it into Google. Check it out. Yeah. No, I'm always looking for places to visit, you know. And, you know, half the time, like, you know, I've sometimes have places on my go, but I, you know, I'll be one place. And I'll be like, hey, what's down the road? You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, and then I'll get in these little hot spots. So one time it was actually in Portland, not Portland, but in Southern Oregon. And I ended up, you know, I hardly moved for like 4 days because it was just like, there was so many cool things to see, you know, but it's a bit of an adventure, but you see the areas where people are clustering and sharing ideas. And that's neat to see like that. They, that way. You kind of, oh, well, oh, you definitely got to see this person's setup. Oh, man, you know? And so you see how they're sharing ideas, you know, and you can eventually trace back kind of like the original seed that was planted or something, you know? So yeah. That's always fun.
Yeah.
But right, yeah.
So where can people, you know, find out more about you, like buy your books or take some of your courses? Where's a good place for them to go?
For sure. Well, you know, for books, I always say just pop into your local bookstore and, you know, order from them, because you're doing two good services. You're ordering a great book for yourself and you're helping support the small little bookstore that, you know, you can get the book through. So that's awesome. And I'm always happy to sell a book. And if you want to get it from me, you can. So you can order from me. But I usually say get it from the bookstore is the best thing. When I'm doing my book launch for a new book, you can order through me. I do a bunch of hand illustrated signatures and stuff on them. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, ecosystem letter U for university.com. I've got an edible property design course that's spectacular. It's 18 modules and it runs through everything that you would need to know to go about transitioning a property to edible ecosystems, gardens, fruits, et cetera. And so it's pretty systematic, and there's, you know, recorded lectures and all sorts of stuff there. And when you're signed up, when it is a period that we're running it live, then you can also access fresh live lectures through that. But you can access the course as long as you need. So yeah, that's a good spot. And otherwise, I'll, you know, if you go to zachlokes.com, you kind of see where I am. When I start my conference tour, I'll be kicking off. I'll be in Pennsylvania at the PASA conference. So that's a good spot for folks to kind of get started.
Right on.
Thanks. Yeah.
Well, thank
you for having me out, guys.
Yeah.
Pleasure.